Hello and welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show we are looking at the all-time classic Casablanca, directed by Michael Curtiz. Returning on the show today to talk about Casablanca is Professor Michael Giuliano. Professor Giuliano, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much.
So is this like the prime example of like when people think of the old classic era of Hollywood, like 30s, 40s, and 50s? Would you say this is the film that is like the best example? If you had to, like, if like intro to film class in high school, like showing this age, would you just show them this movie?
The short answer is yes, and the longer answer is also yes on that one. The thing about it is, when people talk about Hollywood as the dream factory, it was both things. And I would emphasize here that it's the factory. In other words, they are making film after film, and it's on the production schedule, and they aren't sitting down in this case and saying, let's make an instant classic, but often enough, that's how it turned out. But you have to bear in mind, these studios like Warner Brothers had very full production slates. And so in any given year, it's just there on the list, and the director and the actors and many other people are under a studio contract. They're going from job to job.
You know, it's interesting when everybody said, you know, the thing you hear today is, you know, they don't make them like they used to. And when you talk about how it was made on this, you know, very factory-level style, like, they're kind of right, but maybe not in the way they really think.
Well, that's kind of a loaded issue in the sense that when people say they don't make them like they used to, they mean it in a very nostalgic and fond way, as in implicitly or explicitly, the movies were better back then. But even though the greatest films from that period would tend to back up that notion, I theoretically have always thought, you know what, when people talk about 1939 as the greatest year, sure, Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz, and so on, but if you actually went back to 1939 when Hollywood produced several hundred films, and if at least in theory you were to watch all of them, I'm not sure you'd say it was a golden year if you'd watched, you know, 400 or 500 films. They could make movies just as bad as we do today.
Yeah, just, you know, there's always, like, great movies coming out, but then, like, even like 2017 this year, for example, there's been a lot of fantastic movies that have come out, but then you also get some piece of crap like the Emoji movie or the latest Transformers movie, so, yes, there's always going to be great films where great films come out in one year, but then there's also going to be crap that comes out those years.
Well, I've suffered through the films you just mentioned,
I can
appreciate your comment. And honestly, maybe it's a kind of stoicism on my part, cinematic stoicism, but it doesn't bother me perhaps as much as it should, because I subscribe to the hills and valleys theory that you need to have some rather deep valleys to fully appreciate the mountains up above. And then when you do get a great film, boy, does it stand out.
Yeah, my condolences. Though, oh, those are rough.
That's okay. I'm paid for my suffering.
And I would also say that this is probably like the most accessible classic film. Because when you think of other classic films, like for somebody who's never seen like an old movie, black and white movie before, if you showed them like The Seven Samurai or maybe The Seventh Seal or some other kind of classic film, that's great. If you show it to somebody who has never seen a classic film before, they may not like it. But I feel like if you showed them Casablanca, it's got something I think that everybody can like. You can easily follow along with the story. It's got war intrigue. There's romance. It's got everything anybody can like. Like whatever gender, whatever, you know, race or anything, it's just for everybody almost.
Well, the producer and director and screenwriters and so on in a film like this one are out to make a commercially successful film. And what's terrific here is that it's an example of how popular entertainment can be that and a whole lot more. In other words, this was a very carefully thought through, even though it sort of came together by accident, as we can talk about. Mm-hmm. In its own way, though, there's a lot of thought that went into it by way of a social agenda in this film. And it's very much there. By the same token, they don't want to stand at the podium and lecture the audience. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the greatest examples of how popular entertainment can also really carry a message and can really be artful and all those things. But the people going to the movies on a Saturday night are saying, let's go see the latest Humphrey Bogart movie, or let's go see a great romantic picture, or let's just go see something on Saturday night. They're not saying, I want to learn more about our entry into World War II. I mean, typically they're not thinking as you would on a newspaper editorial page, and yet the film functions every bit as well as anything in print at that point, anything intellectual or academic by way of where military the United States was as World War II was breaking out.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting about this movie is we talked about earlier is that it wasn't even really expected to be a classic film. It was just another film on the schedule, like you said. And it's just fascinating that nobody really at the beginning saw like the impact this film was going to have in the beginning.
Well, yes and no on that one. The critic Andrew Saris once referred to it as, quote, the happiest of happy accidents, because there was so much that really was just kind of thrown together and in a sense improvised, or at least done on short notice in this film. Not unusual in Hollywood when films were shot pretty quickly, but this one was notable in that respect. Think about how much changed. I mean, the film itself is based on an unproduced play called Everyone Comes to Rick's, which mm-hmm. I've read, and it's not terrible. It's just hopelessly mediocre. If you read the source material, you wouldn't see a classic film in it. So they took very unpromising source material. I mean, the direct source. There are a lot of indirect sources for the film, including other films, but the direct source was this unproduced play. Moreover, as they started to cast it, as people have noted many times over the years, and there's been some dispute over this as to accuracy, but it's thought that, and I've had people tell me, you know, who would know, that it was to have starred Ronald Reagan and Ian Sheridan in the lead roles. Kind of hard to think of, you know, Ronald Reagan in the Bogart role or Ian Sheridan in the Ingrid Bergman role. And it's, you know, you can joke about that a lot. But anyway, my point is simply that unpromising direct source material, original casting, not so terrific. A lot changes as it goes into production. And indeed, while it was in production, they were literally writing it on the spot.
Wow.
I once interviewed Howard Koch, who's one of the screenwriters of Casablanca. He co-wrote it with twin brothers, Julius and Philip Epstein. And Koch and the Epstein brothers really didn't have much to work with. And Michael Curtiz was just very much, you know, let's get behind the camera and shoot something. And they would supply him with pages on a day-by-day basis. And I spent time asking Koch about that. And he said, that's not an exaggeration. We would sit around the table trying to figure out what to do. And in fact, Michael Curtiz, the director, also many years ago spoke to this point when he said, quote, that picture was made good on the set. I have three writers working on set every day as we shoot, close quote. Wow. And I knew that quote when I talked to Koch some years ago, and I asked him that, and he said, you know what, we would sit around the conference table, and we had that source play, which was pretty lousy, he said, and we more or less knew what we wanted to do, but from day to day, we kept thinking of different ways in which the plot could proceed. Most strikingly, the conclusion of the film. We mm-hmm. knew that, this is Koch, Koch was saying, we knew that somebody would be getting on an airplane at the end, but we went, and probably just two people in terms of letters of transit to get out of Casablanca. He said, honestly, we weren't sure which two people would get on the plane. And so he said, we wrote a few different versions of it and kind of knocked it around. And when you watch the completed film, it seems ordained or for, you know, how could it go otherwise?
Yeah, really.
It's got to be, you know, the way it works out. But honestly, in the scripting, they logically thought of a few possible endings that, again, on a logical level would be plausible, you know, in terms of who gets on the airplane and who stays on the ground. And it's one of the greatest examples in film history of when you watch this classic, it's just so perfectly assembled. And yet a lot of it was put together by chance or on the fly, if you will. Mm-hmm. And Koch said that when they were sitting around the table like that, writing pages, they would be writing for that day or the next day's shoot. And when they finished a page, sort of like out of the typewriter and you know, off to a messenger boy or something who had carried on set, and Curtiz then would have his page for the next scene. So it's really quite dramatic off screen as well as on.
Yeah, and you were even talking a little bit about Curtiz. You know, we talk about, you know, this is armchair directors, we talk about the directors, but I know a lot of people consider that he didn't contribute much overall to the film. Like, he was just like he was just a regular director. They could have put anybody in that role. Like, he didn't really have a much directing style for this movie.
Well, he didn't have much directing style, period. And I'm not saying that as a slam against him. He's a great example of a studio era film director who's an honest craftsman. He made all of his movies, or most of them, for Warner Brothers, which produced Casablanca. He made a total of 88 films in various genres in his career. He literally went from set to set, genre to genre. He's a very accomplished director. In terms of the auteur theory, he's a problematic case because he really does not have a distinctive individual style. But that's to be expected in the studio era when yeah. again, depending on the material and what the circumstances you're working with, I would say that, you know, he does have something recognizable here, namely that there's no flab on this script, on this film. What I'm getting at is, scene by scene, every line of dialogue, every camera angle, everything
yeah.
is really well thought out, even if on the fly, and there's no waste in it. And he knew how to keep a movie going forward like that. And that's an attribute of most studio directors in that period, but he really was very gifted that way. The second thing I would say in terms of this film reflecting him to some extent, or at least Warner Brothers, is that Warner Brothers was the most socially cognizant of the studios. Going back to FDR's New Deal in the 30s with its gangster movies and so on. And in this movie, they wanted very much to be part of the Hollywood war effort, specifically with Michael Curtiz. Bear in mind, he's from the old world. He knows that European culture. He sees it endangered at the time he's making this and similar films. And I would say, polemically, he really is thinking about what he can do for the war effort. Admittedly, he's a studio employee, but on a personal level, he was thinking that. For instance, right after making Casablanca, he made the Irving Berlin-scored musical, This is the Army. Again, part of that promotional mm-hmm. effort to get Americans in movie theaters to think about the war and to boost the war effort. And he also made the pro-Soviet drama Mission to Moscow, which was made at that curious point in 1943 where the Soviet Union was our uneasy ally. Mm-hmm. It was a marriage of convenience. And FDR's cultural czars, our czars, if you will, in Washington dictated to Hollywood that they wanted movies that were promoting, obviously, the Allied cause, but that included the Soviet Union. And there were several feature films and some documentaries that were pro-Soviet. Now, that would quickly, within a few years, come back to haunt yeah. some of the people who worked on those films, because when the HUAC hearings come along in the late 40s and early 50s, it's, you know, not just have you ever been a member of the Communist Party, but did you work on a certain film? And they would yeah. point out, well, yeah, but this was a film that was made by a Hollywood studio and sanctioned. Well, you know, good luck to you arguing the case. Interestingly, one of the screenwriters on Mission to Moscow was none other than Howard Koch, who had been the co-screenwriter on Casablanca. So these were socially progressive directors and writers. And I would say, even though Curtiz directed a spectrum of films, so many genres, if you look at this period, you really see between his own beliefs and what the studio wanted him to do, this kind of coincided. And he did make some of these really socially progressive and certainly war-promoting films.
Yeah, and you had talked about how this sort of reflects sort of the changing mood of Hollywood at the time for World War II, because remember reading one of the books I read, it was Five Came Back, and I remember there was a lot of criticism from Hollywood before we got into World War II when they tried to make, you know, anti-Nazi movies like The Great Dictator. People said, we don't want this. You know, you're trying to get us involved in this war. But now that it was involved in this war, you only see this, but you also see Mrs. Miniver, which came out the same year. So you're seeing a very more accepted tone, I guess, in the American public, where we get these pro-World War II movies.
A lot of Americans today, and I would say arguably at that time as well, didn't fully realize or didn't want to fully acknowledge the extent to which America in the 1930s was isolationist. Coming off of World War I, we didn't want to get pulled into another war there. Mm-hmm. And at the most extreme right end, you'd have Charles Lindbergh and Henry Ford and people who were fascists, I would
yes.
say, racist and all those horrible things. But even though the polling that we take for granted wasn't quite as finessed back then as it is now, the general feeling among historians is that in the very late 1930s and into the early 1940s, a majority of Americans did not want to become involved in another worldwide conflict. It's important to remember that World War II begins on September 1st, 1939, and the United States doesn't enter really until Pearl Harbor. And in our present context of our discussion, the fact that Casablanca was made very much with all that in mind, to get America away from its isolationist stance and fully involved in the European conflict. The Bogart character directly references that in some of the dialogue. The script, which was really sharp in many scenes, reinforces the point, not only what's going on in Europe, but that Americans, though, really can't sit back, shouldn't sit back.
And there's even that line when Bogart's drinking at night and he goes, I wonder if it's nighttime in America, and I wonder if they're sleeping all over America, and you know what that line means.
Now, here's the biographical context there. The Bogart character, of course, is a man of few words and rather crusty and not at all sentimental. I mean, he's got deep feelings, but he'd be the last one to talk about his deep feelings. But think about it biographically as in the politics of this film. A lot of the political references go by very quickly. Admittedly, audiences in the early 40s would have picked up on some of them more quickly than we might today. But in any event, these were not things that were dwelled on by his character or by the film. But the character he plays, Rick Blaine, had been a gun supplier, a gun runner, if you will, initially in Ethiopia when Mussolini was conquering much of North Africa. And he supplied guns to Haile Selassie and to the Ethiopians. That's 1935. In 1936, he supplied guns to the loyalist side, the Republicans, in their fight against Franco and the fascists. He, of course, lost both of those wars, if you will. Now, when he's confronted about that by the police captain, the whole issue there is, well, you know, where's your political ideology? What's your stance here? What do you believe in, and so on? And what's interesting here is, this is really where Captain Renault, the Claude Rains character, really kind of puts him on the spot. Captain Renault is talking with him, and he knows about Rick's background in Ethiopia and in Spain and so on. And Rick tries to shrug it off. I'm a businessman. I sell guns, and that was just like a deal, whatever. And you know, whatever he might say against Captain Renault as a corrupt Vichy official, he's a very smart and very clever man. This is the Claude Rains character. And he points out that, well, you know, in both those situations, the other side, as in the fascists, would have paid more if he'd sold guns. And Rick just kind of, he's actually at that moment, it's one of the few times when he's rendered speechless. He smiles like, you got me. Yeah. It was a gotcha moment. But back to your citation of the quotation there, the specific situation is that Rick, late at night, is sitting down with his piano player, Sam, and again, that's something implicitly progressive on a political level. The fact that, on the one hand, you could say, well, Rick's the boss, he runs the cafe, and Sam's the African-American piano player, and it's sort of a, to put it bluntly, kind of master-servant relationship, or employer-employee, however you want to describe that. By the same token, and even more so, I would say, Rick does not open up to many people. He opens up to Sam, he trusts Sam, he admires him. That's why when at the end he decides to sell his cafe, he insists that Sam gets a fair deal. He gets a good cut of all that. There's an eye-to-eye relationship there. They respect each other. And Sam actually will sort of sometimes set him straight. Sam will talk back to him politely, but he will talk back and that, well, you know, Rick, you should, whatever. And so anyway, the situation you're referring to, the scene rather you're referring to, they're sitting down late at night, they're talking to each other, and real heart to heart. And Rick, having been so embittered by losing politically in Ethiopia and in Spain and losing romantically with what happened in Paris, the misunderstandings there, which are political in origin as to why he got separated from Ilsa and so on. It's political more than anything that pulled them apart. And he only understands after the fact what happened there. Anyway, he's been so bitter that that's why he has this stance of, I stick my neck out for nobody. I'm an isolationist. I run a bar in Casablanca and everyone's welcome so long as they behave in my bar. Germans, French, you name it, they're all welcome if they behave. So anyway, late at night, Rick and Sam are sitting around, and the quotation you're citing, here it goes exactly, quote, Sam, if it's December 1941 in Casablanca, what time is it in New York? I'll bet they're asleep in New York. I'll bet they're asleep all over America. And that's one of the great lines or speeches in the film, because it reminds us and reminded the audience back in 1942 that this story takes place in very early December 1941, just a few days before Pearl Harbor, which was December 7th. And America, having been so isolationist in the late 30s and early 40s, so many Americans, as I said before, did not want to get pulled into another world war, even after it started. And some of them, frankly, were, if not borderline fascist, I mean, there was an American Bund back then, but enough Americans actually had attitudes that nowadays would make us uncomfortable. But you know what? Our hand was forced, as we all know, at Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And the reason many people aren't fully cognizant of what happened in that period and how American public opinion changed is that it changed literally in a day.
Yeah, yeah.
It changed so quickly that we, in a sense, almost renounced by forgetting where we were just before Pearl Harbor. And that's why this mm-hmm. film, quite brilliantly, reminds audiences that it's our war. We can't sit it out. We've all got to get involved. And that's essentially what the whole romantic story is about as well. You've got to re-engage, and re-engaging politically and also romantically. I mean, on all fronts, to open up that way and to fight for what's right.
And even not only with the story, but even with the casting of the film, it's making a statement, because many of the minor characters in the film are European refugees, like the big waiter. He was a refugee. I even noticed the guy who runs the casino was a star in many Renoir films.
That's
so
right.
He's coming from there. Famously, Conrad Veidt, who plays Strasser, he was in The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. He was a big star, and he came over here to America and played pretty much the Nazi in most of World War II films.
Right down the line, when you look at, and that was one of the glories of the studio era, when you referenced that earlier, the fact that they had deep casting, and not just the stars, but even more so, I would say, or mm-hmm. as much so, with the supporting players. What would Casablanca would be without all those colorful characters yeah. sitting around in the cafe? And, you know, you mentioned, you know, Conrad Veidt, Peter Lorre, any number of people who were coming from Europe, from European cinema. Some of them had come over to the States prior to Hitler's rise to power. Some came over directly as a result mm-hmm. of it. They all had firsthand experience of, in their own lives, you know, the countries they were from and what were happening to them now. They were certainly well-prepped. They certainly were primed to play these roles. Since you mentioned Conrad Veidt, just briefly there, ways in which ironies are funny and not funny. He's best known in the silent film period, you're right, for playing the somnambulist, the monster, yeah. if you will, in Cabinet of Dr. Caligari from 1919. When he comes over to Hollywood, in the silent film period, it's not an issue. In the sound period, it is. The German accent, what do we do with them? And so Conrad Veidt goes on working, but he fled Germany to get away from the Nazis. And then the cruel irony is, what did Hollywood cast him as? Most often as a Nazi. And the poor guy, that's in fact, in Casablanca, he plays Major Strasser. Strasser is the German commandant, if you will, or commander. And essentially, Strasser is running the show. In Vichy, France, you know, that's a collaborationist government. So nominally, Captain Renault, the Claude Rains character, is in charge of the Vichy French government in Casablanca. That's nominally. We all know that, you know, who's really pulling the strings is Major Strasser, the German commander there. And so they have a lot of diplomatic interplay there with a kind of smile and a wink as to what the real deal is. And so the real heavy in the film is not Renault. I mean, Renault's a deeply flawed man, but he's a very likable guy,
yeah.
too. And he ultimately does the right thing, and that's what matters at the end. Mm-hmm. Whereas Strasser, of course, is just right out of central casting. He's the German Nazi villain. And how cruel in its own way, and that's why I kind of smile at how just how cruel it is to have an actor like Conrad Veidt play it very well.
Oh, yes.
But Conrad Veidt's political beliefs were the exact opposite
yeah.
of Strasser's. But he's got the German accent, mm-hmm. and that gets
he
him
plays
the role.
A great Nazi.
He plays a very convincing Nazi, mm-hmm. and he certainly knew what he hated, so I suppose that's a kind of research for him.
Another thing I want to talk about in the film is I think the score by Max Steiner. I think the way it almost it feels like one of the first films that kind of plays with that theme, like the theme of times goes by as time goes by, and that's, even though that's not his song, you can definitely just hear that just theme that da-da-da-da-da played throughout the entire movie, and this is one of his best works.
Well, that kind of motif is something characteristic of, well, screen composing, but particularly in the studio era, when you had a great theme, and it could be a pop song, or then again something from classical music, whatever the case might be, the ways in which that recurs. And there's some very funny examples from film history, and sometimes deliberately funny, where that music's always popping up. And like, for mm-hmm. instance, if two characters are having a romantic moment in the apartment or walking on the street, and then they get in the car and they turn on the car radio, that's the music on the car radio. You know, it's inescapable. That's the song. But again, it's that kind of full immersion in the story, and the music here is just wonderfully embracing. It really is perfect for those scenes, and it's not shy about repeating itself. And I say that as a compliment here. that it really just gets you locked in and you know it'll recur. And after all, that is a really great piece of music. You know, I mean, you know, as we're talking, I'm singing it in my head, if you will. And so why not repeat it?
And even just, not only with that, but I even love the opening theme as, you know, once the Warner Brothers fanfare plays, and then it shows the map of Africa, and it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's even that theme, I think, is really good.
Well, yeah, and again, it's really, although it doesn't want to get on the soapbox and stand there for too long, it does get on the soapbox right from the get-go. For instance, and things that could go by quickly unless you know to look for them even, that audiences in the early 40s, I think, would have understandably been more perceptive about. But for instance, in the opening action scene where somebody's being chased on a street and shot dead and all that, on a far wall, there's a poster, and you see a silhouetted and outlined figure. Well, that's Marshal Pétain, who had been a French war hero in the First World War, and then as a collaborator became the president in Vichy France, the head of the Vichy French government, very closely allied with the Germans. But that was a very distinctive profile that people would have recognized from postage stamps and coins and posters and all sorts. And in the film, nobody comments on it. And yet, you can see it there on the wall, and anyone going to the movies in the early 40s would have recognized, well, that's Marshal Pétain. We're in Vichy French territory. So it's not just that we're in Casablanca. We have a sense of who's ruling the place at that time. And that's why at the very end of the film, when Captain Renault is going to finally do the right thing and renounces Vichy-French collaboration, almost as if to celebrate going for a drink of water, and it the bottled water, the mineral water, is Vichy water. And then, of course, he looks at the label and throws it in the trash can, which, again, we can appreciate today, certainly. But back then, people in a heartbeat would have realized exactly what that's all about.
Yeah. And just watching this, looking at Claude Rains' character, watching this movie again, you kind of almost sometimes forget how kind of sleazy Claude Rains' character is, because it's sort of implied briefly, but that these women are coming to him for visas, and the way they're getting the visas is if he's sleeping with them. So it's almost like a casting couch kind of thing. Like, I can get you this, but you got to do something for me. And you forget how kind of sleazy that is.
Let's put it this way. When you go to the headquarters there for the Vichy French government, he has an outer office and an inner office. And it's like, show her right in. And particularly if it's a really beautiful woman looking to get out of Casablanca, and she's desperate, and she has a tight sweater on, he will say, well, come into my office, and we'll work that out. And so, it is casting. It's absolutely casting couch. Also, of course, the corruption, and this is the example everyone knows, within the Rick's Cafe American there's a lot of gambling going on. But when Strasser wants the place shut down because people are singing La Marseillaise and so on, Captain Renault, is enough of a logical person. He says, on what grounds, what pretext, what do we say to shut this place down? And with the gambling, and of course, he says he's shocked to discover this gambling
line
going on. And then just a moment after that, of course, the croupier comes along and gives him his earnings, which he quickly pockets. So this man is thoroughly corrupt. But you know what? He and Rick have a very honest relationship with each other. They each have their role to play. And Captain Renault early in the film will do what he needs to, as in what Strasser wants him to do. So he would pursue Rick there. But they respect each other. They actually genuinely like each other. And Rick will say that about Renault. He's always been fair to me. He's been honest to me. And they like each other. Those are the grounds, the underpinnings for the eventual friendship that becomes them going off together. They're on different sides, if you will, from the get-go, and there's mistrust there, and they would do things to do in the other, if you will. But there's always that respect between them. They always, frankly, like each other. And so it's totally plausible at the end that the two of them would go off. And where do they go off? Well, when they walk off at the end, going off into that fog, and of course, this is very much a studio shot film.
Yes, yeah.
It's the airport in the back lot, if you will. But when they're in that studio back lot and they walk off into the fog there, they're heading off to Brazzaville in the Congo, which is a free French outpost.
Oh, okay.
So where they're headed is removed from Vichy French control and controlled by the Free French, namely Charles de Gaulle and that side. See, that's again where in the script it's mentioned so quickly that an audience in the early 40s, for the most part, would have picked up on references like that. Audiences today, honestly and understandably, need a little bit of a nudge sometimes as to where they're going and why. But again, for a script that was tossed together from day to day, it's really brilliant, it's really efficient, it's really carefully put together, even though the circumstances might seem not careless, but just kind of impromptu as to how it came together so quickly with the Epstein brothers and Howard Koch literally writing from day to day.
Yeah, and you know, we talked about a lot about Claude Rains, and I think we've almost forgot to talk about just the two big star-making performances of Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman. Now, Bogart at the time, it's hard to believe nowadays, but he really wasn't that huge of a star. This is the film that made him the big A-lister. Before this, he was best known for, like, he did The Maltese Falcon in 41, but he was always known as, like, the private eye or mostly the gangster, the heavy, like in Angels with Dirty Faces or Roaring Twenties.
Well, let's put this in context. When you mentioned the studio history at Warner Brothers, he was one of those contract players in the 1930s who really went from film to film. If you look at the filmographies of an actor like Humphrey Bogart or, you know, look at Jimmy Cagney, any number of people, Betty Davis, so many of them, and not just Warner Brothers, but in the early 30s, early to mid-30s, it's not unusual for them to do 7 or 8 movies in a year. They would go mm-hmm. from set to set. And a lot of those movies have been more or less forgotten. They're just titles, but there's some notable ones. Now, in Bogart's case, he most often in those years would be playing a gangster, like in a supporting role. And good work, but you know, not above the title, if you will, not all that well known. It's really in the late 30s he starts to get more recognition. He had some, but gets more. And you get High Sierra in 39, and certainly Maltese Falcon. I mean, things like that really are starting to make his name. But to your point, this is the film that really makes him not just a big star, but an iconic star. And he's going to have that status for the rest of his relatively short life. You know, from then until he dies in the mid-50s, you know, he's top box office. So that's why when people discuss Humphrey Bogart, you know, and show a few clips, there will always be something from Casablanca.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, it's got to be there.
And then his co-star is Ingrid Bergman, and she was still very young in her career at this time. I believe the only other film she did before this was the Dr. and Jekyll and Mr. Hyde movie.
Well, her case is different, though, in the sense that I've seen a handful of the films she made in Sweden back in the 1930s. And she did and in fact, films like Intermezzo she would remake. There was a Swedish version she made, and then she'd remake it in Hollywood. So anyway, her case there is so different in that she's working in the Swedish film industry in that decade. And then as she gets to Hollywood, you're right, absolutely right. This is early in her Hollywood career. And the challenge here within the Hollywood industry is because of that background, I mean, to get right to the point, because of the accent, you have to find roles that would work for her. So in this film, of course, she plays Ilse Lund, and her character, Ilse, is said to be Norwegian. So, you know, to American ears, certainly to my American ears, a Scandinavian accent's a Scandinavian accent. Does it sound Norwegian to you, or Swedish, or Finnish? I say, well, it's Scandinavian, and that's good for me.
And even as she kind of uses that accent a little bit again, and, you know, we see it 4 years later with Notorious when she's playing a German.
Yeah, and again, that's something that could be frustrating for the actors. Because of the accent, it both created those roles and in some ways kind of limited them, because that's the kind of part. I mean, Comrade Veidt was the example we mentioned before where it really would limit what he could do in Hollywood to be a Nazi. She had a lot more range and a lot more opportunity. But even there, you know, certain roles probably weren't offered to her because you'd have to, or what they'd have to do is like somehow finesse it in the script. And Hollywood was always good at this, and Shameless as in, well, why does she have this accent? And they just like without shame would work in some line as to, you know, well, you know, she had a nurse from that country or something. You know what I mean? I'm speaking hypothetically, but they'd find some like really loony reason why that's why she talks the way she talks. But, you know, joking aside, it really in many ways kind of predicated what sorts of roles she would get. And to your immediate point, you're right. This is the film that absolutely made both Bogart and Bergman iconic performers.
And I believe, like we talked about earlier, I know Bogart wasn't the first choice for Casablanca. I believe this is one of the famous roles that George Raft turned down, didn't he?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Poor George Raft. I shouldn't feel sorry for him. It's his own fault. But I mean, he was very good in gangster movies in the early 30s. The original Scarface from 1932, you know, Paul Muni's Scarface, but he plays the sidekick. And he's really good at that kind of a role. But honestly, I don't think he was the world's smartest man in some ways. And people make fun of him and should for this. But there's a long list of films that he turned down for various reasons. Double Indemnity was on that list, Casablanca. Sometimes he would turn down a role because he thought it wasn't a big enough role for him, like it wouldn't be the star role he wanted. Mm-hmm. Other times, who knows why, but he let's put it this way, he did not appear in all that many great movies, but he turned down a lot of great movies.
Yeah.
And he would have to answer for this as to what was going on there. But, you know, joking aside, it's easy to pass judgment after the fact. Before the fact, I mean, Casablanca going into production was not the most promising or prominent of material. And so, you know, you couldn't blame somebody for wondering should they do it or not do it. Talking about it in the early 21st century, anyone who said no to it seems like a complete fool, I realize.
Yeah.
But from the perspective of, you know, 1941-42, you could people are considering roles through their agents and might go for one thing or another. Sometimes it's choice. Sometimes, you know, studios, of course, when they have people under contract, have a way of leaning this way and leaning that way. So there are various factors to consider.
Yeah, and you were talking a lot about just how at the time it wasn't considered that big of a hit, but obviously when it came out, it was a huge success. It won Best Picture at the Oscars. And you not only with that, but you also see so many copies of Casablanca in the following years. I wrote down a couple of examples. Another Bogart film, which also was big with him because Lauren Bacall was in it, was To Have and Have Not, which you watch that film, you can't help but think of Casablanca. The stories are almost extremely similar. And then there was Passage to Marseille, and then there was Conspirators, and those movies have a lot of the same people. I think Bogart's in one of them. They also kind of have Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet in a couple. So there's all, or Paul Henreid. There's always somebody from those movies in these films. It's always kind of somewhat similar to Casablanca.
Well, what's funny is you're absolutely right. And it's not just, though, that Casablanca comes out. It's a critical and commercial hit. It's always had classic status, best picture status. It's not just that these other films are copying Casablanca, which is absolutely true, but Casablanca itself was copying films. The most prominently, a film in 1938 called Algiers. Charles Boyer. And that's a film where the setting is very similar. It's that Orientalism, as Edward Said would say, that sense of that the West has, that America and Europeans have, of the exotic, quote-unquote, cultures of North Africa and the Middle East. Take me to the Kasbah type lines,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so Algiers, it's actually a very good film, you know, for what it is. Is just soaked in that kind of ambiance of the Kasbah, mm-hmm. with, you know, women lounging around, mm-hmm. and all kinds of gangsters doing what gangsters do, and all kinds of intrigue, and that ultra exotic setting, very sultry, kind of pushing the envelope that way a bit. And that came out in 1938 and did very well. And I know from talking with the screenwriter Howard Koch about what influenced them for Casablanca. As I said before, the source play, the unproduced play, Everyone Comes to Rick's, was mediocre material. So he and the Epstein brothers were actually thinking as much or more about recent Hollywood films that they wanted to kind of improve on or update, if you will. So Algiers was in their mind as they made it. Secondly, and even more topically, the Allied invasion of North Africa was recent news. And he and the Epsteins were thinking about that. Why don't we have a story that's very much set in Morocco and in northern Africa like that, and have the war play out in North Africa? And as we were discussing earlier, the extent to which that conflict was one of the things that was going to sort of force our hand. In other words, it's becoming a worldwide war. It's not mm-hmm. just in Europe. It's in Africa. It's in the Middle East. It's spreading outward. Shouldn't the United States, a kind of moral imperative, shouldn't we get involved in this for the sake of humanity, you know, not just for our mm-hmm. own individual stake in affairs, but just for humanity in general? We need to intervene here. So they were thinking, again, of recent movie history, but also very, very recent, as in contemporary political history.
Yeah, and you were talking a lot about the play Everyone Comes to Rick's. I do believe, I remember reading up a little bit about it, like 40 or 50 years after Casablanca came out, it was to renew the copyrights for some reason for the play, that they had it run for like a week in somewhere in a London theater.
Yeah, that sounds right to me. I'd have to check on the details of that, but it has been published just by way of all that enormous critical literature around Casablanca. And I've read it, and you know, it's not terrible, but it's not at all promising. But this is a case of where they really invest it with much more than is in the play itself. For instance, one thing we haven't fully addressed yet is the extent to which Casablanca is not only based on contemporary politics, but functions as a political allegory. So could we talk about that for
sure,
a moment?
Sure, go ahead.
This is something quite fascinating, and it shows how these screenwriters, working under those conditions of cranking out the pages, did have a kind of conceptual framework or what they were thinking there. And it's spelled out in more detail by a film scholar named Richard Corliss, who's published a book, actually some years ago, a book called Talking Pictures, Screenwriters in the American Cinema. And what I'm going to quote you here is actually Corliss's theory, and you're free to agree or disagree with it, but just to give a sense of how you really can make a case for it as allegorically about, yeah, this small cast of characters, Rick and Ilsa and so on, but then what do they all represent? Because each major character represents a different nationality. Mm-hmm. You know, so you have these different nationalities and political vantage points, and beyond that, are they standing in for various political figures? So here's what Corliss says about it. Quote, Casablanca is a political allegory with Rick Blaine as President Roosevelt. Casablanca is Spanish for White House. A man who gambles on the odds of going to war until circumstance and his own submerged nobility force him to close his casino and commit himself, first by financing the side of right and then by fighting for it. The time of the film's action, December 1941, adds credence to this view, as does the fact that 2 months after the movie Casablanca opened, Roosevelt, Rick, and Prime Minister Winston Churchill, Laszlo, met for a war conference in Casablanca.
Oh.
Like the very best Hollywood films, Casablanca succeeds as allegory, popular myth, clinical psychology, or whatever, and as a superb romantic melodrama.
I think that works perfectly because I remember reading that a lot. Like I do see that Rick can be President Roosevelt, and he's going through the same things and changing his stance from isolationism into fighting.
Because Roosevelt, bear in mind, as popular as he was flirting with unpopularity in mm-hmm. the very late 30s, early 40s, because he really was committed, most obviously, to Great Britain. I mean, mm-hmm. but he couldn't really do much there because Congress was extremely mm-hmm. isolationist, and the American public, I would mm-hmm. argue, many would argue, was the same way. And so that's where, in the late 30s into the 40s, he couldn't really supply direct military aid, but he could supply materiel. And so that's where the United States starts to supply munitions and other things to the British. But it's a ticklish diplomatic thing as to what can get through Congress, what he can do on his own, and so on. But he's building the case for American intervention in the Second World War. But he's got to be careful how he does that because, again, initially it's not a popular stance, and he's flirting with rebellion even within Congress and within the White House from some of his secretaries because they don't all want to get into the war. He's not just leaning that way. He wants to get into the war. And that's why the character of Rick can be seen as somebody who initially is going to sit it out, but then really realizes he needs to get in.
We've kind of not talked a lot about Michael Curtiz, and we talked a little bit about his past and how he's this reliable studio director. He has had a lot of success doing a lot of different movies. One of the things I talked about was Angels with Dirty Faces, which is a gangster movie. Back even after this, he did one of the classic film noirs with Mildred Pierce. He did a classic Errol Flynn movie with Robin Hood, and I believe he's one of like five people counted as director on The Thief of Baghdad from 1940.
You're absolutely right, but it dovetails with what we were saying earlier, that he's a really gifted studio craftsman. The virtue of what I call velocity, in other words, going very quickly from film to film, but within a film, he worked so efficiently and so quickly, And they would give him a script, and that's his next film. And imagine going, you've mentioned some great examples of going from genre to genre like that. Those are films which have virtually nothing in common otherwise, right? That's apples and oranges, if you will. But that's a sign of a studio director in that era. And even directors that we tend to think of as being action-oriented, dramatically inclined and so on, Howard Hawks or something like that. Well, that's, you know, you look at Hawks' career, and he made quite a few really great comedies as well as the dramas, and he made westerns and gangster movies and musicals and all sorts of things. And so even though we tend to have an image of someone like Howard Hawks, for that matter, even like John Ford, you look at John Ford, dozens and dozens of films, some of the ones that haven't held up all that well or we don't even tend to think about at all, you look at them or at least look at the titles and read about them and you realize, well, he wasn't just making westerns and stories about the Irish. He was making all kinds of movies along the way, particularly early in the career. You know what I mean? When you look early in the career of a Howard Hawks or a John Ford or William Wellman, those were the tough guy directors. So, yeah, they made the tough guy pictures, the gangster films and dramas and westerns and all that. But, you know, again, when they were under contract, particularly, whatever came along, and they made all kinds of movies. And if you're gifted, and that's why, that's one reason why John Ford in particular would poo-poo and actually rather rudely reject people talking about auteur theory, him as an artist. You know, I make movies, you know, I just set up the camera. And I know it's somewhat disingenuous on his part to take that stance, but the other guys, you know what, people like William Wellman and Hawks is a somewhat different case, but certainly people like William Wellman, they just saw themselves as workaday directors. At least that's the image they projected. And so it would not be unusual to go from one genre to the other because you're making pictures. They didn't call them films. They called them pictures. We made pictures.
And like especially compare it nowadays when you have the big name directors like a Christopher Nolan or Tarantino or whatever, the big names, like they don't do movies like every year. They do it once every 3 years so they get time. And like you talk about the Fords, the Hawkses, a lot of these guys are pumping out one every year, maybe even more.
There are various reasons for that. One, it all comes down to money, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In the studio era, it was really a blessing. A lot of directors have said this. In fact, some of the younger directors you've mentioned have actually said with a kind of envy, I wish I'd been around in the studio days. You'd think, why? You'd have like handcuffs on as to what you could do. But the advantage of it, the blessing was the studio was its own little city. It was a factory, as I say, the dream factory. So when it came to costumes, makeup, sets, casting, whatever, a lot of it was right there ready to be delivered. You know, you could very quickly greenlight a project and make it. The budgets were moderate in most cases. The studio had covered its bases there, and you didn't have to worry about a number of things. And most studio bosses more or less would leave you alone if you came in on time and on budget. And so you just go from movie to movie. And some great movies. And in fact, ironically, the origins of the auteur theory are in that very situation, which would seem to be anti-auteur. But the reason that it's there, if you look at the careers of most prominently Alfred Hitchcock, but also these other directors like Ford and Hawks. Hawks is a great case here. Working within the strictures of the studio system, the directors I just mentioned and quite a few others were able to put their individual stamp on a film, even as they went from genre to genre or less than promising circumstances in some cases to other films that maybe weren't so great. But still, they had an identity. They had the smarts. It was a Hitchcock film, a Howard Hawks film, whatever. And so, again, the auteur theory is something that kicks along from the French New Wave to America through Andrew Saris as much as anything. And from that time in the 60s and 70s, particularly 70s, to the present, it's what that younger generation of directors like Tarantino just take for granted as their birthright, that they're auteurs, that you make a Tarantino film. In that respect, it's so important to remember that back in the studio era, only a handful of directors were known by name to the general public. And in fact, it's perfectly fitting, and I asked Frank Capra about this once, about his autobiography. The title of his autobiography is The Name Above the Title. In the 30s, Capra said he was so proud that when his films were being released, he had made Columbia a bankable studio, and by that period, they acknowledged it by allowing him to put his name above the title of the film. And by the mid to late 30s, all Americans would have known Frank Capra as a name. He was as much a star as his stars. But only a handful of other directors had that kind of clout. Cecil B. DeMille, going back to the silent film period had that. John Ford had that kind of public recognition. And if we were to go into more depth here, really, it's not that much more depth in the sense that only a handful of directors in Hollywood in the classic studio era, specifically the 20s, 30s, 40s, into the 50s, only a handful of directors would have names that the general public would have really known. A lot of the others, including some that are lionized today, would have been known to cinephiles for sure, and people really loved the movies. But to the folks who just went to the movies on a Saturday night, you know, they're not saying they want to go see a Michael Curtiz picture. They're going to see Bogart, right?
Definitely.
They would have seen the name Curtiz often enough there'd be recognition. But again, it's not quite the same as celebrity.
Yeah, and another thing you talked about, why they would have to work around not only with the, you know, the difference between today with producing films like where Nolan or Tarantino could do one every 3 years, where they would do it every year, but another one would be the Hays Code. So not only would they have to pump them out every year, but they would always have to find a way to, if they can work out like talk about something violent or sex or anything, they got to find a way to work it around where they won't get censored, but they, I mean, face heavy censorship, but they can still get it through.
When I would talk with directors from that era, like John Huston, Frank Capra, and so on, or screenwriters like Howard Koch, they would talk about the Hays Code, the production code, as a mixed blessing. Bottom line is, they would have been happier if it weren't there. I mean, they're artists, right? They want to do what they want to do, right? They don't want those restrictions. And we could spend hours talking about the Hays Code as to how ridiculous it was. But you know what the mixed blessing is? And they would acknowledge this in interviews. They would say, you know what? And Billy Wilder talked a lot about this. It forces you to become creative. Like in Double Indemnity, films like that, there's a lot of innuendo. There's a lot that's suggested. And in some ways, it's much more powerful because a lot of that's off screen. Like in Double Indemnity, when the murder's carried forward, you never see it on screen. It takes place just outside of the frame, and you hear it, and you see the facial expressions of the killers. That is so much more powerful than a Tarantino-type graphic close-up of somebody's with blood spurting out. And so directors then and screenwriters then would talk about it at the time and certainly in later years. And today, a lot of people do talk about that it forced you to become creative and to think of ways to convey material that you frankly couldn't show directly on screen in terms of language and sexuality and violence and all sorts of things. And so again, even though I'd be happier without that production code, how many great films were made because of it? I mean, directly because of it, that the directors and screenwriters had to find ways to convey all that to the audience without going up against the censors.
Yep. Okay, so we're getting close to the end of my questions here. Anything else you want to bring up? One thing I kind of find it funny we forgot to bring up was Paul Heinried, who is Victor Laszlo in the movie. And it's funny because it always seems like he's the one kind of forgotten about in this movie. You know, he's one of the main stars.
Well, you know what's interesting is because it has such a terrific cast, you're absolutely right that, you know, how can you not talk about Rick and Elsa and Captain Renault and, you know, the major players, and but the minor players are not so minor. Ironically, if Victor Laszlo is sort of forgotten, that kind of factors into the story itself. I mean, namely that, you know, Rick and Elsa had this great love in Paris, and then for these political reasons, they're pulled apart, and she's not able to fully explain to him at the time why she doesn't show up for the train and on that way, and he's left feeling like a jerk with the rain running down a letter and so on, as if it were metaphorically tears, all that. Yeah. And the bitterness he has towards her, really hatred, until she's able to finally, you know, years later explain in Casablanca what happened. But this ties into what you're saying about Victor Laszlo, the sort of forgotten character, if you will, the invisible character played by Paul Heinried. The thing that's funny there, in a way, is that that's so perfect for the plot, because bear in mind that Ilsa's from Norway, Victor's from Czechoslovakia, he is a leader of, a hero of the resistance movement. She's married to him. What she knows, she has to keep secret, of course, and so she can't reveal all this stuff to Rick back in the day, back in Paris, and it's got to stay secret. And she and Victor have a love of their common cause. They are fighting the Nazis. They're both in the resistance. They have great respect for each other. It's not a head-over-heels passionate love. And they're both upfront and honest in that respect. Mm-hmm. They really love each other. But again, it's because of those shared values. And so in many ways, Victor Laszlo is very much around, but oftentimes he's sort of like the edge of the frame, or if there are three people in the shot, he's the third one over. He gets some great moments in the film, and it's a really gifted performance, so I'm not slighting that. But the nature of the character and the nature of the story is such that, the real love interest, the real heart-pounding stuff is Rick and Ilsa. Victor is high-minded. He fights for the worthy cause. He's respected by everyone. And frankly, as a character, he's not quite as much front and center on screen, and he's not quite as interesting in a way as the other characters. And Paul Henreid actually gives such a first-rate performance because he conveys all that without really being boring, but just indicating that Victor's this high-minded character doing the right thing. But honestly, who would you want to spend time with? I think it'd be much more fun to talk to the other characters than to Victor, because Victor would give a political sermon, right?
Mm-hmm. He's just, and did this hurt Heinrich's career? Because I think this is the only film of his I remember him from.
Well, no, he actually, he was never like a huge, huge star, but he was a star, and certainly, you know, with Bette Davis and others, he had a lot of good roles, actually. In the Hollywood firmament, he's not up at the top the way Bogart and Bergman would be, but he would be that sort of second-tier star there. He had lead roles and appeared in a lot of movies, and he's really good at what he does. And you know, and Claude Rains, you know, likewise, not huge, huge star, but a very successful career. And these are really gifted actors, and here they really nail those roles, don't they? I mean, they're ideal for those roles.
Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing director Michael Curtiz and his 1942 classic Casablanca. Don't forget you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com or the category Armchair Directors. Professor Giuliano, I thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed it.
All right. For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on here.